This is Jane McGonigal, the author of Super Better and a big fan of the Psych Tech Podcast. You're listening to Psych Tech Podcast, where you will get the future of psychology and technology.
Welcome to Psych Tech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast. My name is Josue Cardona. Kelly is not here this week, but instead I have an interview with my new friend, Dr. Tom Guariello. He's a psychologist with years of experience, and he's a professor in the Masters in Branding program at New York City's School of Visual Arts, where he teaches a course called The Meaning of Branded Objects. Speaking of the School of Visual Arts, we recorded this interview in the studio where Debbie Millman records Design Matters, which is a very long-running and popular podcast. If you've never heard of it, it's actually really good if you're interested in design, and it was exciting for me, at least, to record in the same spot where she records her show. So why is Dr. Tom Guariello here? Well, he's working on a project called RoboPsych, which is about the psychology of human-robot interaction. What more is there to say other than the moment I heard human-robot interaction and psychology, I wanted to talk to him. So here's my very, very fun interview with Dr. Tom Guariello about his project, RoboPsych.
So when I was super excited about finding you because, and I have it written down, right? When I read, RoboPsych is about enabling effective, efficient relationships between people and robots.
Yeah.
And I am your target audience, right? Like me and Kelly, Psych Tech, that is, we talk about like the human side of technology is the way we kind of like to tag ours. And, you know, futurism, anything new that comes up, we start, you know, doing our own kind of analysis and hypothesizing. And I know I saw on your podcast that you interviewed Kevin Kelly. You know, I woke up early that day when the book came out and I went through the whole thing. I think by the next day I was done with it and I was so excited. Yeah. And then the next episode we did was, I called it, the new buzzword. My new favorite buzzword is cognification.
Uh-huh. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Right. That, what if it's 12? Yeah.
So we're definitely your target audience, but what is RoboPsych and what are you doing with that?
Well, RoboPsych is an idea that I cooked up basically, in thinking about, what it's going to take to be highly effective at interacting with robots as collaborative tools. I've spent a lot of time working in organizations developing frameworks and models to look at what it takes to be the best at any particular position. Competency models, they're called in the organizational psych world. And so, you know, for example, in the retail world, an excellent store manager can make up to like 20% difference in sales over someone who's average or below average as a sales manager in a particular location. So corporations have spent a lot of time trying to figure out what are the cognitive, emotional, and behavioral characteristics of people who are superior performers in important roles. So when I thought about that model, that competency approach, I thought, gee, you know, this same model can be brought to bear on what's it going to take for people to work really well with robots. And so that's where, and when I started thinking about it, this idea of RoboPsych just popped into my head, and I started doing research into human-robot interaction, which I was a novice at. I knew nothing really. I've been a technologist for a long time, started using technology, bought my first computer in 1982. So I've been working with computers for a long time. But I really had never studied anything about human-robot interaction, human-computer interaction. I had spent a little time looking at. So dove into the literature and found a fascinating body of literature, much of which is aimed at designing the robot side of the relationship, if you will, between people and robots. And I'm interested in looking at the human side, what it's going to take for people to be successful.
Yeah. Computer interaction is so different, right? Because you know the difference between someone who's really good, even if it's just like keyboard shortcuts, you know, they're faster, they're more efficient at doing something. But you're right, robots are a different thing, right? Because of conversational interfaces, right? Because of all these different ways that we're interacting with them. So there's a super clear distinction.
I think so. There's a, you know, I'm sure there's a Venn diagram that, you know, we could draw that would show where the overlap between competencies at using a computer and competencies at working effectively with robots. But there's a significant portion that doesn't overlap because of that, you know, anthropomorphic element, you know, and our impossible to avoid characteristic of, you know, attributing human characteristics to objects. And these humanoid objects, some of them looking a lot like people, others only a little bit like people, are always going to evoke those kinds of responses from us, which means that they have a more complex emotional makeup than just interacting with Excel.
Or Word. Just a window, right?
Yeah,
just something
exactly.
like that.
Yeah.
And such different interfaces.
Yeah.
Something that, as someone who's played video games his entire life, it's so, for me, it's very natural to pick up a different game controller and the interface is completely different and I'm playing a different game and I'll switch immediately.
Really good analogy, yeah.
And a lot of people can't do that, you know?
For sure.
Not even with TV remotes, right? You change, it's like, this is the VCR one, what's happening? You know, they want to throw it out the window.
Right.
And with computers, it'll be exactly the same way, but I think maybe more difficult, maybe easier, depending on the interface and depending on the design.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the context, you know, is going to make a huge difference. So, if I'm working in an office, and I now am going to have a robot, air quotes robot, that is a software enabled productivity enhancement mechanism, and it and how well I use that. It's kind of like Alexa, you know, with on the Echo. If I can ask Alexa the right kinds of questions and get satisfying answers, or ask questions that can't be answered of Alexa. Now, Alexa is a robot in the sense that it's an automated, algorithm-driven system, but yet we very quickly fall into conversational mode with Alexa. Some of us, others of us, it's harder. So at work, people are going to fall into that same kind of distribution curve of who's really good at this and how do we help? The most important part is how do we help people who aren't so good to get better at doing this? And that's where a competency model can really be very helpful because it helps to focus in on the things that people can improve in order to get better at doing a skill.
Yeah. To use video games again as an analogy, Microsoft has Cortana, right?
Yeah.
Which was actually a character inside a series of video games. So they hired the same actress, right, to do the voice. And that may not mean a lot to people who've never played the game, but to people who have played the game, that's a beloved character that you've known for 10 years and now you're able to interact with her.
That's really a big difference, isn't it?
That's super exciting for me. Except that I can't work with Cortana. She doesn't understand what I say. She doesn't really get me. And so in terms of how it's set up, it's built into Windows now, but it's also built into the Xbox.
Yes.
And the microphone, like, you know, at the beginning, that was their big push. And I couldn't stand it. And I ended up disconnecting it because I couldn't deal with the original version. Now, when Cortana came out through an update just a few months ago, really, it's designed to control your television and your entertainment experience. So it's very limited. You know, I can't ask her what the weather is or other things like that.
Right.
And I was frustrated. So even though with controllers, I'm very good with her, like either she doesn't understand my voice or I was saying the wrong commands and I ended up just disconnecting her. Right? They're disconnecting the interface. She's still in there, right? But I disconnected the microphone, and so I don't use it anymore because it was just too frustrating. But I find that with Siri, I don't have that many issues.
Uh-huh.
And we actually did an episode, and I'd love to hear your opinion on it. We called it Which AI to Buy, right?
Yes.
And it was, essentially, it was Google Assistant was just announced,
yes.
right? And then Alexa and Siri. And I went back and forth, and I ended up, at the end, we ended up joking that we're going to have all of them in our house, and we're going to ask Siri to tell Alexa to do something, you know, just because we can, and they're all speaking to each other.
Yes.
But I wonder, how do you feel about them, if you've interacted with those three, which are the main consumer versions, the ones that people have in their pocket, even if they don't realize
yes.
it. And those things are evolving every single day.
Yes.
And they do things today that they couldn't do yesterday. And to where do you stand on any of those, or just in general?
Well, I think they're very exciting because we get a chance to learn how to communicate with another species, basically. And this is a first for us. We haven't had voice communication with technology so deeply intertwined with our lives before. And so I find them very exciting. I think I got an Alexa the first week that they were, the Echo, the first week it was available. I was, you know, an early prime. Yes, send me one of those things. And now I have another one. I have two of them, a little Dot in my office and one that we have in our family room. And the Alexa's become a normal part of our lives now. My wife and I always use Alexa to do timing, to do music, to do things that I would often Google in the past, reach for my phone and Google. I'll just now ask Alexa the question. If it's a factual, you know, I unconsciously know the kinds of domains that I can point Alexa to and know that I'm going to be successful. Siri, I'm less successful with. I have an iPhone. I had an iPhone ever since there was iPhones, and had Siri ever since there was Siri, but I still don't quite get how to communicate with Siri. Do I say, "Hey Siri"? Oh, I said, probably shouldn't have said that, but do I, and then what happens? Do I say Siri again? Do I just say a sentence? Do I say, and even when I think I have the syntax correct, it seems like I trip up with something about the wording isn't quite right. And so that's a me problem. I understand it's a Siri design problem, but it's now a me problem. I have to figure out how to get better at interacting with Siri, or I'll stop interacting with Siri at all, I mean, altogether, which I don't really want to do, because I like having an agent who can do things for me, schedule appointments. Like, for example, I can never get Siri to put a to-do on the right list. I can't ever get that right. I don't understand, you know. So Siri to me is a little more frustrating than Alexa, probably because the scope is broader as well. I know I've never bought anything using Alexa, although I know I can. I've never asked. I know I can ask Alexa to put things on to-do lists for me, but I never do. So it's kind of like I have these compartments already set up in my head about which of these things I use what for.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, we kind of had the same story from Cortana to Siri, from Alexa to Siri, right? Yeah. And for me, Cortana was the one that I couldn't stand.
Well, but you had a history. That makes it even more interesting.
It was frustrating,
That voice for you had a 10-year history, and then to have your expectations really disappointed by this iteration of Cortana.
It was. Oh, actually, on that point, my Siri, I have it set to the male British version.
Oh.
So when people say she, you know, yes. Siri is a she, I forget, because for me, Siri is a British male. It's like, I feel like I'm, you know, like I have my own Alfred.
I understand.
Right?
Yeah.
And it kind of, it makes the relationship of like, he's my helper easier, because I associate it with Batman and his Alfred, you know?
That's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And I don't know if that, I've never thought too deep into it. Like I don't feel comfortable asking my mom to like wash my clothes, you know, I didn't used to do like that. And so maybe the female voice kind of, it made me feel more uncomfortable than actually just using the male voice. And I found myself using it way more that way.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Now I'm really going deep into it now.
And these really are the kinds of personal determiners about how we use technology. So in this RoboPsych model that I've been developing, what I wanted to do was to kind of explore, well, where does this stuff come from? Where do these attitudes come from? And you know, I think about it as, you know, kind of, you know, a mindset and then knowledge, skills, abilities as all components of what RoboPsych is. And so when you sort of start to look at, okay, I developed this model for this class that I teach called The Meaning of Branded Objects, which is about where meaning comes from. And the model that I developed was around what I talk about as hardware, firmware, and software. Our hardware, firmware, and software. Human, the architecture of meaning as having hardware, firmware, and software components. A hardware is neurophysiological systems, sensors, the brain, and basically, what the hardware delivers to us is emotion. So if you take that kind of classic Ekman, you know, six emotion model, fear, anger, disgust, sadness, surprise, joy, you take those six, they're hardware. Anywhere you go in the world, you're going to be able to count on people having those emotions, and you can pretty well read them on their faces as well. We signal emotion very well. It's been a nice evolutionary advantage that our ancestors passed along to us. So hardware. So for example, when we see a Terminator-like robot, the fear that everybody all over the world has of that robot is hardware driven because it's designed with a red eye, you know, when it's sort of decomposing, you know, it's designed to scare you and it succeeds in scaring you. And from a hardware perspective, we know that we can count on that reaction. When you move up what I call the stack, right? You move up this meaning stack to firmware. What we're talking about there is culture. So we have cultural context for our meaning-giving reactions to things. And so when you look at Japan, for example, and the cultural context of robots in Japan versus the cultural context of robots in the West, it's dramatically different. In Japan, robots have a very different, first of all, they have a very different kind of relationship with objects, religious-based perhaps, but then a very, which is cultural, firmware kind of level. But then they have a whole history of making these automata that go back to the, you know, 15th, 13th century. These wonderful, entertaining, functional kinds of dolls that were joyful. They really made people happy. And so the firmware context, where in the West we have monster context of robots. Robots are there to kill us. They're there. Every story that we ever grew up with in, you know, from Frankenstein as a kind of a robot on has always been, and you know, Metropolis, the early 20s films, the fearful cultural meaning of the phrase that we now use automatically, our robot overlords, right? That whole firmware-based reaction is also there for us in the West. So we're kind of predisposed towards fearful negative reactions. And then software is really our own unique individual psychological history. So once again, when you read and listen to roboticists and particularly roboticists and AI researchers today, many of them will talk about what it was to be a child and to watch and to see Star Wars. And so they had a software connection with R2-D2 and with C-3PO that was very joyful, very positive, and inspired many to go on to become professionals in this field. So that meaning stack is to me how we can look at training, helping people to understand, first of all, okay, you know, your reactions are, take self-driving cars. When people talk about self-driving cars, you can tell their mindset, their attitude towards these devices very quickly, because many of us are afraid of being in a car that we don't control, even though we get in taxis all the time and so on. There's another person there, so we feel like we can relate and respond. So there's a lot of unlearning that's going to have to take place on the part of older people. Now we're at that firmware level again. Your early history with automated things might be very scary, but children who today grow up with technology that speaks to them, that they speak to. I mean, my two grandsons, 11 and 9, have been speaking to Alexa, and now they have their own Alexa to speak to. So this is going to be a very different set of firmware and software components that they have in their RoboPsych than those of us two who are my age, for example.
As you were talking about like Japan, I thought of the like Astro Boy, right? Which is
really
such
their first
like friendly, helpful robot. But really, we had Pinocchio, but they have Astro Boy, right?
Yes.
So we had a doll made out of wood, and they have a robot.
Yes.
And it's because of that culture, right? And I'm thinking to all these examples as you were speaking of. Even if it wasn't a robot, the machine went wrong and that's what created the monster or
absolutely.
Something like that, right? Instead
yes.
of being helpful. And you're absolutely right. I mean, that's ingrained in us if that's how we grew up.
In the book that I'm writing, I go through decade by decade history of the cultural imagery that we now have as part of our Western and in particular American cultural contextualizing meaning drivers for robots. And, you know, there's a lot of bad, not
yeah.
all that much good.
Yeah. Okay. So then I had some fun questions and then we'll jump around.
Yeah.
But I thought these would be fun. And I'll give you an example of what I'm looking for first. And then I'd like to hear your opinion.
Yeah.
So what was the first time that you saw a robot in fiction, right? Kind of what we're talking about, that you really liked or wished was real? Now mine, I thought really hard about this, and I think I'm pretty sure that mine was Rosie from the Jetsons, right? Kind of this someone I would love to have a Rosie at home because she's helpful, she cleans after me, I don't have to do all this stuff, and so I'm curious what was that for you, that first one?
I guess Rosie was very early for me as well. I'm older than you are, and the positive examples were not that plentiful when I was growing up. And we had, you know, the day the earth stood still, you know, kind of a horrific, you know, Gort kind of robot monster. And we had, of course, all of the if not robots, robotic-like characters in like Flash Gordon. And all of those were evil. They were all, they had one job and that was to kill us. Rosie was a little bit, because number one, female, and number two, I won't say ridiculous, but fanciful.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
the apron really made a big difference in how you
yeah,
perceived
yeah, yeah.
her, and the little hat,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know. Made her not dangerous, not threatening. And of course she was very practical.
Yeah. 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 Rosie. Who knows what effect Rosie had on me?
Yeah. On a lot of us, I think.
All right. So that's fictional. So what is the first robot that was ever available that you wanted to buy? And mine is so clear. I was so excited when the Sony Aibo came out, the first robot. I wanted an Aibo so badly. And I think, I didn't look this up, but I think they were like $1,000 or something like that when they first came out in 99. And I never wanted a pet so badly. I never wanted a device so badly. I thought it was so cool that it could learn. I never thought of a robot that could learn, right? And that was, but it felt possible. I knew I could call Sony and ask, where do I buy it? And they'd take my money and I could get an Aibo. So that was my first one, which was yours.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you would say Aibo because I saw my first IBO at the TED conference in, I'm not going to get the year right, but it might have been 98, 97.
So it was that first one with the floppy ears, yes, and like the long
yes,
face.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And walking around in this space in the TED exhibit, not they don't have exhibits at TED, but in the common kind of area, they had this device. And I can't say I wanted one. I could say I was fascinated by it and thought it was a an amazing development, but I didn't have any real strong desire for one. I have to say, my Jibo's been on order since day one of
still
Jibo.
Hasn't shipped?
Still hasn't shipped, no, but it'll soon. It'll be here, I'm told, soon. And I have a buddy on order also, which is a little more humanoid than IBO is. And I'm looking forward to that. And I'd love to get a Pepper. I really would, I think if they sell out, in tranches of 1,000 in 5 minutes in Japan every time they're released. I would really like to have a Pepper. If it wasn't $8,000, I wouldn't mind getting a now, because they're terrific for kids. I'm really excited about the prospect of taking robots into schools, and the whole FIRST Robotics campaign, is a very I think a great development, helping kids to learn how to create robots, and those are terrific robots for taking it to school. RoboSapien kind of little things as well. So that size is really terrific. But $8,000, I don't know. I don't think. So. Yeah.
I think the wow factor is so important, especially for kids.
Yeah.
I still remember being in school, elementary school. I must have been kindergarten or first grade. We're all sitting on the floor, and they brought in an Apple computer, and I'd never seen a computer before. And I still remember that moment when that thing came in. And now you can't show a kid a computer and wow them into wanting to learn more. They have phones and they have tablets that they're playing with. Right? Even the cheapest Kindle for kids, which is covered in foam, is so advanced, right? And has Alexa built in and all that stuff. It's I can't imagine. Okay, so this is another one of these questions. What is the most exciting thing? Actually, I'm going to preface this one with, you've chosen a field that is so rapidly evolving. I can't keep up. My two favorite websites right now are Futurism and Motherboard, right? And every single day in my inbox, there are multiple things where I can't believe that 2 weeks ago I was talking about new brain mapping techniques and now there's three more, type of thing. And with robotics, it's the same exact thing. There's so many things happening so quickly. And so I'm curious, I have one that I read yesterday, right? But what is the most exciting new development that's happening right now for you? And mine is it's called the Alias. It's a self-driving retrofit.
Oh yes,
robot.
Right. Yes,
right. So you were talking about self-driving cars before, and kind of our relationship around that. And I've made that transition from, I don't know how I feel about that, to I want this in my life right now, because and in my case, I had a very bad car accident when I was in college, and I've had PTSD symptoms related to driving for years. And actually, the worst nightmares, I don't have the nightmares anymore, but the worst ones were me not being able to control the car.
It's a awful feeling, yeah, of course.
It's the worst. And now I want every single car, because I don't think it'll be okay until every single car is self-driving. And so I've thought, I had already accepted, well, it's going to take so many years for what Tesla is doing to be done by every company and laws to come in and say, well, now you can't have a driver. That has to be self-driving because we know that it's so much safer. And I thought that's a really, really long way off. But the idea that you can retrofit any vehicle with a robot that will do the self-driving, I had not thought of it. I mean, it's obvious now that that I read it, but the fact that it's happening and it's flying a plane. So if it can fly a plane, it can fly a car. It's so exciting for me right now because I feel that was maybe the missing link to kind of bring that closer. It may still be 30 years, right, till that happens.
Could be, sure.
Yeah, but that makes things a lot different, you know? Because if that robot is, I don't know, 5x3 right now, in 3 years it'll be much smaller, you know, and it'll be, oh, I can't wait to just stick one in a car, you know, and now it's self-driving and it has the same software that the Tesla has, right? You just need to add a few sensors, some cameras, and you're good to go. Oh, that's mine. I'm curious what yours is.
Well, mine is an agent who has such a deep understanding of me and the things that I care about that is always on the lookout for those things. And so it's kind of a combination of several different kinds of systems. But, you know, I want to be able to have, you know, it's kind of like Watson reading all the surgical journals and then telling the cardiothoracic surgeon, hey, here's this article that you really should look at. Let me tell you what it says. And so it's kind of got elements of Watson, this ideal agent of mine, and then has a creative element to it that says, basically, I know you love this stuff. And by the way, here's an article about Arsenal. And that's really, you know, what you care about. And this Arsenal article, by the way, also has some relevance to psychology because it talks about the training techniques that Arsene Wenger uses to train. And so that kind of connective intelligence as well. I haven't seen one of those yet, but that I might pay $8,000 for.
So maybe like a Jarvis, right?
From Iron Man's Jarvis-y, Jarvis. Very much kind of in that conversational intelligence that is really plugged in. And it's not a slave, you know, not the robot word slave. It's really a partner, you know, because I do have this belief that we are developing the potential to have these kinds of virtual partners that we will be able to count on. Just like, you know, we count on, we count on Google to just be there for us, to answer questions for us and to do things for us. So, you know, I implicitly count on Google to keep all my mail, you know, so that when I want to go back and find something, it's there. Google's taking care of that. And, you know, maybe Google's reading it too. I'm not sure why Google would be interested in my email, but whatever, you know, whatever. But it really is that partnering element that's most exciting to me.
Yeah. I wrote a couple sidebars for a book called Iron Man versus Captain America, right? I'm very geeky. Uh-huh. Psychology, it was a psychology book really talking about these two characters when the last movie came out. And I argued that Captain America can never beat Tony, you know, Iron Man, because it's always Tony who's already a genius,
right?
Plus Jarvis.
Yeah.
And anything that Captain America does is going to teach Jarvis to be better. So there's no way, you know, because he's always plus that, you know, as Iron Man. Alone, it's different. But that idea of having a partner, or even before that, right now, a friend, those chatbots that we're seeing that people don't realize for up to 20 minutes that they're speaking to someone who's not a person, you know, and there's, to be able to have that kind of interaction, not connection, right? Connection comes maybe later, but that they know you enough to say the right thing or help you out in so many different ways. It doesn't matter what it may be, right? But that, I love that idea. Yeah, and we're so far from that. That's why we're going to have 20 different chatbots and agents and robots and doing all these different things until there's kind of a unified and then that's where people always say that's Skynet, and then you get into that scary conversation.
Of course,
but I'm way more optimistic. I'm way more optimistic. I it's so exciting to get to that point.
Well, the chatbot side of things is interesting. Another kind of oh my God kind of moment for many people. You know, I can't believe people are actually talking to, interacting with this with this algorithm and revealing, you know, that goes all the way back to ELISA, you know, the MIT labs with, you know, people becoming comfortable interacting with something that simulates interest. And we know that the manipulative potential for those kinds of interactions is pretty high, you know, and so we do have to, you know, we do have to be careful about the ethical side of what we're talking about. I'm involved in the an ethical committee for IEEE around manufacturing devices and products that have AI components to them and the potential for abuse of those components. This is not, you know, this is something we have to be mindful of, and we don't usually think about a combination of engineering and ethics necessarily working together hand in hand from the very earliest moments of product development, but this is a case where they really have to.
And from now on, I mean, that's just the way it's going to be. Every time we, and I'm sure every time you have a discussion with someone about ethics in this field, there's no end to it. You just go around and round and round, and right. People's beliefs come into it. They're essential now. You can't even start these conversations without.
Impossible.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course the trolley problem, you know, becomes the sort of first case. Well, you know, how do you do it? And look, you know, Mercedes just said, okay, we're resolving this. We're resolving this. Our algorithm will always save the passenger. That's the way we're resolving it. Well, now we'll have a discussion around that. And now people will make choices around purchasing a Mercedes that has that algorithm built into it or not, or they will give their feedback to Mercedes and say, no, I want to have more personal decision making built into mine, or I'm going to go with a company that makes different ethical choices in their self-driving car. But we're raising these things from the implicit to the explicit level of conversation, which is really important.
Do you know, I know that the federal government has, I think, the four different levels of self-driving, right? Four or five.
Yeah.
Are ethical considerations in any of that?
Ethical considerations?
Right? They're going to have to update them.
No, it's all mechanical. It's all mechanical capability related and with no mention of the ethics.
Yeah, because we'd assume that you could choose the Mercedes over the Toyota one, but we may not have a choice, right? In a different country, you may have a choice, but in other countries, that may be very clearly dictated. And the ethics system in the government employee vehicle is very different than the one in the civilian employee. Like things that this is what happens when you start talking about this.
Exactly.
And spiral, and it's just like, what? I don't
know. Yeah, and it's, you know, it really does. The encouraging part of this is that ethical conversations have not been a part of a lot of public discourse, and now they're going to be, you know? And so, you know, technology raises uncertainties in our culture that have been invisible and sort of, you know, brings them out. Like, you know, Internet of Things, the whole idea of having, I mean, even having now an Echo in my home that is, and this is in quotes, listening to me all the time.
You have two, you said.
Right? I do. I have two of them.
You can buy a six pack and get one free now.
I saw that. I don't yet have the need for six. But the fact that it's listening to me all the time makes a lot of people very uncomfortable. I, again, feel as if, well, it is listening to me so that it can hear when I need it to do something. Now, I can think that there are other nefarious motives that are at work in listening to me all the time. And the first time I get any evidence of that is when, you know, Echo goes away.
Maybe, but, right? We think that.
For me, the first time, let me finish one sentence at a time, which is something I'm not always that great at. The first time I get any evidence of Alexa using conversation that was not intended for her in a manner, in any manner, that will be the moment when I will disconnect and take her away. Now, I'm sure there are people who would say, oh, she's already doing it. I don't know that. I don't have any evidence of that. But if I do get evidence of it, that'll be a whole different story.
Yeah. I used to always keep Hey Siri. Oh, I said it off. Yeah. And then eventually I turned it on.
Yeah.
Because I said, let me see how much more convenient it is. And I like it.
Yeah.
But then you don't know, right? I mean, not like the only specific, I mean, when you say nefarious, immediately think of ads, but there's so many other ways that it can happen. But Facebook has this feature in their app. You can turn it on and off. It says, you know, hey, we can listen to you and tailor your apps to, I think it's the moment you start writing, it turns the microphone on. So anything you say during that time can be used to then target ads. And again, that's in the fine print. That's, you know, something that most people aren't aware of. And when I read that, I immediately went and made sure that that was off because I didn't feel comfortable with that.
Right.
But I could also see one day, like, oh, maybe I'll turn it on. Like now I find myself watching TV and getting bombarded with commercials that I don't like. I've almost like, if to watch the show for free, I have to get ads. I guess I might as well get ads that apply to me, you know? And that's a very slippery slope, right? When you start opening that door.
It's a complicated, it definitely, we have to make more choices about these things than we've had in the past when we were just simply mass targets. Now we are increasingly personalized targets than we were. And when the Internet of Things mesh network emerges from all of these billions of objects that are going to be in our homes, communication capable and learning from one another, again, in big quotes, but somehow connecting with one. That's a big moment of a conversation that's also going to take place. As we saw, you know, with the hacks a couple of weeks ago, when your refrigerator is hackable and can connect with millions of other, in the case of a couple of weeks ago, 150,000 other devices, we've got to do something about that because that isn't in keeping with the sort of permission-based privacy and security beliefs that we have.
And is that a cost of entry that people are willing to accept? Like it becomes a reality. Oh, well, I do have 27 different devices in my home that are connected.
Yeah.
I figure this is going to happen every now and then, or my bandwidth is going to be affected. And again, those are things that who would have thought we'd have a conversation like that just a couple of years ago.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Have 7 Echo Dots in your house. I mean, yeah. that's a problem.
Imagine how crazy you have to be to have that. Even 2.
So robots, I think robots are hot right now, right? Like people want to talk about them. And I was all about virtual reality a couple weeks ago, right? I got my first VR headset.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I've said it many times, but I feel like I live in the future finally. You know, that's what I was waiting for. And then HBO's Westworld came on.
Yes.
And
episode behind, so don't spoil episode 4.
I will not spoil anything. I would never. That is a value of mine. That's in my software. I started upon just seeing the first episode, I realized virtual reality is nothing because the creation of that environment really is that. And now we're talking about robots and humanistic. And I think it's the first scene where you realize that, what they're talking about is just adding very small tweaks.
Yes.
Because they'll make them more human and how people will relate to them.
Yes.
Right? I mean, I had to bring it up because this has got to be the best thing to ever happen right now for somebody who's invested in this.
It's a pretty great example
of
so much that is imminent with, and by imminent, you know, it could be decades, but, you know, imminent. It doesn't. You don't have to be Jules Verne to imagine the kinds of things that we're seeing in Westworld, and it's without spoilers. You know, it's a pretty classic psychoanalytic story. Of sex and aggression being given free rein in in the world. And we know that that's always been an attractive environment for people to, you know, whether it's, you know, well, you know, fill in the blanks of ways that we have used those two major impulse id components in the real world and entertainment, and in and so Westworld is a great example of that, amped up to 11, you know, on the scale with great technology and terrific subtlety around the way the robots are designed and the way they function and the way people then interact with them as a result of that design and functionality. It's been great fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. And now people are talking about this, right? Which is so exciting because we can go into a lot of these hypothetical conversations. You can go into the ethics. The ethics are very, very prevalent, right, in this show. Like, what happens when, I mean, from the very beginning, right, there's so many things going on and you're like, wow, I don't know. Like, what would you do in that situation? Or what would you ever treat a robot that way?
Yeah.
And are they still robots? Yes. Right. And then, but what if they mean more to you than that? I mean, there's so many different.
Well, and then that's critical. You know, the studies about attachment and robots, particularly in caregiving settings, are pretty powerful. I mean, elderly people, particularly, again, in Japan, where the culture, you know, is different, as we've talked about, you know, the paro, that kind of seal,
yeah.
Baby seal-like robot
yeah.
Elicits lots and lots of deep emotional attachment among patients in rehab facilities in Japan. And, again, many people are deeply disturbed by that. I'm not so deeply disturbed by it because I'm, you know, the argument always is, well, why don't we have people to give that kind of comfort? And that's a great question. Why don't we have people who give that kind of comfort? We don't. And in the absence of that kind of comfort, is a robot better than nothing? I think the answer is clearly yes. And so developing attachments with, I mean, we have attachments to our cars. We have attachments to, you know, lots of us have attachments to, like, I don't know, tools of all kinds, electric devices.
Name them.
Absolutely. Yeah. They are, you know, they have personalities. We talk to them. You have to be quiet because if you don't do this, it won't work right. You know, we have all this magical thinking around objects that we've got. So imagine when we're interacting with them, like in the case of Westworld, where they're extremely humanoid, and it'd be a miracle not to form attachments with them.
I'm just as fascinated about the world that exists outside of Westworld, because if those robots have existed for 30 years, how are they being used in other places inside, right, on Earth, right? Or who knows how far things have gotten?
Yes.
I can't say something about the last episode, but
no, you can't. not yet. And you know, we don't even have to go to Westworld. I mean, you know, sex bots we're going to see a raft of sex bot offerings here coming up very quickly. We already have them in Japan. We know we've got them already in Europe. A woman who I interviewed on my podcast, Kathleen Richardson, from Montfort University in Leicester in England, she's a very strong... she's leading a very strong conversation around the impact of sexualized robots and, you know, what that's doing to people. And so it's again, one of these discussions that is raising to an explicit level things that have been implicit for a long time. But now we have to come to terms with them because we're starting to get to those questions about, well, what does it mean to be human then? What does it mean? You know, what kinds of relationships are we going to think are human life enhancing, and what kinds do we think are going to be human life damaging? again, yeah. not a conversation that we're common to have in the 21st century yet.
Yeah. One of the first episodes we ever recorded was called Don't Date Robots. And it was a reference to a scene from a Futurama episode.
Uh-huh.
Futurama, one of the great future forecasting media of our time. and that was over a year ago. And again, there's been so many changes. This is a field.
For sure.
It's just so exciting.
Well, it is exciting, and again, the negative attitudes are pretty powerful, and I really want to try to help us to get to where we are able to use the tools that are going to be right there for us to use that are going to be so enhancing. I mean, when you think about, you know, the partnership between, you know, an expert surgeon and a robotic executional device.
Like Da Vinci, for example, is one thing where it's like
tremendous opportunities. Yeah. You know, like so far, all robot surgery has been relatively primitive. We're about to make another big leap in functionality in that area. That's going to be a tremendous partnership. I want the best doctor and the best robot surgeon to work together.
Yeah.
Right. And if I need another, hopefully not another back surgery, but if I need another surgery, that's who I'd love to have doing the surgery on me, is that partnership. Bring those together, just like the chess championships now are won by combinations of people and AI. That's what's going to happen for us. And we've got to learn to get past some of these psychological barriers that we have to embracing this technology and using it to our benefit while being cognizant of all the potential downsides that they bring.
So to continue that conversation with you, right, if people want to know more about your work, where can they go? Where can they find you?
Well, they can find me on at robopsych.com. They can find the RoboPsych podcasts wherever podcasts are gathered for you. I have a bi-weekly or bi-monthly, depends on however. Every other week, I publish a newsletter called the RoboPsych Newsletter, a free newsletter in which I take one idea that's come up in the past couple of weeks and just do a brief sort of reflection on the idea. This coming edition, which will be coming out on Friday, is about women in robotics. There seems to be a movement of women having a strong role in robotics that maybe we haven't seen in other areas of STEM domain. So that's another place. And I'm on Twitter at Tom Guariello and at RoboPsych.com. So maybe we'll have all that in the show notes.
Absolutely. In the show notes.
That'll be great.
So many links. All right. Thank you, Tom, so much. Hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Again, for more about RoboPsych, go to RoboPsych.com. For more Psych Tech, visit PsychTechPodcast.com, at PsychTechCast on Twitter. Kelly is Kelly N. Dunlap on Twitter. I am Josue A. Cardona on Twitter, and we'll catch you in 2 weeks.